The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Kevin Fong. And I'm joined today by Alok Jha. And no, we haven't been double booked to present the podcast. This is a handover of sorts, but also a chance for me to quiz Alok and Guardian filmmaker Lawrence Topham on their great Antarctic adventure, or misadventure, as we'll discover. Along with dozens of Antarctic researchers and enthusiasts, Alok and Lawrence set off on their expedition in December last year, retracing the journey of the great Australian explorer Douglas Mawson. But as we'll discover, the Southern Pole and its icy expanses are unpredictable and precarious, even for the most seasoned of travellers. Stay with us for an Antarctic edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. So Alok, of course, needs no introduction, but a warm welcome to Lawrence Topham, The Guardian's top draw filmmaker and video journalist. Welcome to Science Weekly, Lawrence.
Thank you very much.
It's good to see you. So you've had a fairly epic journey since I last saw you, Alok. Tell me a little bit about Antarctica and what happened to you.
Kevin, welcome to my seat, first of all. I'll tell you something. The last time I saw Kevin, about a few months ago, just before I left for Antarctica, he was walking down the Euston Road in North London, shouting at me, "You're going to die! You're going to die! You're not coming back. I want this and that from your will."
I feel partially vindicated in that opinion.
This is my friend Kevin. Anyway, Kevin, lovely to see you. And as a helicopter aficionado yourself, we've got, you know, it's quite an interesting story we've got to tell you. So anyway, the reason we went down there was to follow an Antarctic expedition. I mean, as journalists, we kind of report on the ends of scientific research quite often on this podcast and elsewhere all the time without really going through how science is done. And so this was an opportunity to try and do some of that. And we were offered a place, me and Lawrence and I, were offered places on the Australasian Antarctic Expedition, which was a century on from the original Australasian Antarctic Expedition. And this was led by one of the great heroes of Antarctic research, Douglas Mawson. He was a British-Australian guy. And along with Shackleton and Scott and Amundsen, he was, you know, one of the real top Antarctic researchers and explorers, one of the first people to explore East Antarctica. And he led an expedition in 1911. He took a bunch of people, you know, on a wooden ship down there and ended up at Commonwealth Bay. The day he arrived, it was blue skies, gorgeous. Turns out that Commonwealth Bay, where he landed, was the windiest place on Earth. I think that he had, 70 mile an hour winds on average for 2 years. That was the average, with gusts up to 300. So, you know, it was a tough environment. And then he obviously he pioneered a huge amount of research, did a huge amount of geological research, mapped the place at the geomagnetic South Pole, weather, all these things. He was the first person to take wireless down to the Antarctic. He took a plane down there, although it never flew, so they used it as a sort of air tractor. He was very successful, and he came back in a hero. And very few people know about Douglas Mawson compared to the others. I mean, you've all heard of Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton. And the expedition leader on this round, Chris Turney of the University of New South Wales, who himself is British, he quips that maybe it's because Douglas Mawson didn't die that we haven't heard of him, although he had his own problems.
So, Alok, tell us a little bit about the journey down, because I mean, even that in and of itself is, you know, something of an epic journey.
So the Antarctic now is, it's full of people in many respects, because there are bases all around the edge from many, many countries. And there's a sort of annual logistical exercise to resupply everything. So in a sense, it's like getting a bus down there now. It's a bit more complicated than that. But ultimately, there are ships and planes and all sorts of things that go down there. We went by ship, and we went from Bluff, right at the bottommost tip of New Zealand. New Zealand, beautiful country. I think we saw the least nice bit of New Zealand. But anyway, it was just a dock. We left on December the 8th, and it took about 8 days to get to Antarctica, which 8 days of which we had to get used to each other on the ship, there's 50 of us, and also the Southern Ocean, which is the roughest sea in the world. If you read again Douglas Mawson's diaries, he was laid out with seasickness for a week. And this is a hard man. This is someone who did some amazing things in Antarctica. Two of his colleagues died. He trudged through the Antarctic for a month by himself. Essentially, his skin fell off and falling down crevasses. And the guy was hard. He was laid down for a week with seasickness.
Lawrence
and I, a day. That was all. And that was we were up and about after that. So, you know, in your face, Mawson.
How do you account for that? Why were you
drugs,
better off?
Basically, give you these little patches that you can stick up behind your ear.
I think drugs, but a lot of people had seasickness medication on the ship. But, you know, different people just deal with it in different ways. There was a couple of scientific researchers who've been to Antarctic many times still, who every time they go, it takes them 4 or 5 days to get over it. I think it's just personal. There's nothing special about it in terms of how you deal with it. And the drugs maybe help you, but I don't think that they're, for most people, they work that well. I certainly had the patches, and Lawrence, we both had patches, but we stuck behind our ears. Didn't work, so we took other pills. And essentially what they do is make you go to sleep. I think that's the only way to sort of deal with it. You're a doctor. You know how this works.
I'm just amused by this progression of Scott, Shackleton, Amundsen, Mawson, Jar.
Hey, wait, don't, we were all in there. Anyway, so just to talk about the journey a bit more. So you have the seasickness for the first day or so, and being on ships is quite a strange experience if you've not been on them. I haven't, certainly. You know, the walls and the floor are constantly moving, and I found it quite amazing how quickly you get used to it. I mean, it's disturbing at first.
And Lawrence, I mean, Alok has established himself as the Guardian's answer to Bear Grylls here, but how were you and more importantly the other passengers you talk about, because we talked a little bit about the people, how did they respond? Were there any people who weren't up to it? I mean, I can't imagine that everybody thought it was straightforward.
No, I think there was a diverse range of experiences in the passengers. I think some we just didn't see for several days. I think a lot of people retreated to their cabins and had to hunker down there. I do remember myself being on the first few days at sea, lying in my bed, feeling awful and thinking, Alok, what have you done? I can't believe you've brought me out here. I've got to cope with another month of this. But it did ease. And I think people began to bond actually quite quickly. I think there were some lovely things began to happen, seeing the wildlife outside and this kind of, and there was a nice communal area where people kind of congregated. And so it engendered this sort of spirit where people began to kind of really kind of talk to each other and mix. And also just the dinner times. I think that because you'd go to the galley and you never knew who you'd be sitting with. It was always a bit potluck. So it was quite nice because you got to sort of mix with different people every day and learn about who they were and where they come from. And there was such a lovely different mix of experiences and reasons why people were there.
Let's fast forward now to, you know, arrival in Antarctica and what were your impressions? I mean, I guess it must have happened gradually, but what were your impressions of moving into that landscape?
The first things that we saw were small ice floes. We went to bed one night and we'd gone through the choppy sea, and then the next morning we could look out the porthole of our cabin and you'd see these small clumps of ice. And we sort of travelled through that for, was it a couple of days? And then there was this extraordinary moment when Alok and I, along with our the radio producer, Andrew Luck Baker, we were on the front bow of the ship doing some recording, and it was a very grey, misty day. And Alok and I were filming, and Alok was just describing what it was like and what he could see. And suddenly, in the distance, this weird alien shape was sort of beginning to kind of emerge out of the fog. And at first you couldn't even tell what it was. Was it a ship or was it a, you know, a bit of land? And then gradually it became obvious that it was this ginormous iceberg.
I mean, you've seen pictures of icebergs in coffee table books. I mean, better pictures than any we could take. But just seeing one up close and just what the surface looks like and the different shapes. And then as we got closer to Antarctica, we sort of came through an alley of icebergs. Essentially, the skies cleared up and the following days, icebergs were everywhere. And like I said to you, you have to sort of stop yourself from going wow every morning because you're seeing completely new things. And there was a day or so where we just sailed through it was, must have been, what, 70, 80, 90 icebergs all round us off into the distance. We were just sailing through them as if they were nothing. And there was like an honour guard of icebergs before we hit land, as it were. And we literally actually did hit the land.
We actually crashed into the ice. The Schakowsky deliberately skewered into the fast ice, and fast ice being the ice that is actually locked to the continent. And we did this to sort of wedge ourselves in so that we could make a secure landing. And that was extraordinary. I mean, you just hear this awful crunching sound as the metal bashes against the ice. Alok and I were on the front bow of the ship as this was happening, and the whole ship would rock, and you know, you'd almost fall over, and it was quite dramatic. And then you'd see these sort of tiny colonies of Adelie penguins right by the ship, sort of frantically trying to get out of the way and running in the opposite direction, and then coming back. And it's amazing how it felt like the penguins gravitated towards the ship. They seemed to be almost curious or very unfazed by your presence there. They sort of were just sort of grouped around you and looking at you in a sort of like, oh, what are you, you know. And it was amazing how close they came to us.
Tell me a little bit about the science as it gets underway. I mean, what was that package of science like? What did it include? What did they achieve?
The science for this expedition was something that had been planned for several years by an interdisciplinary team. So it wasn't just climate scientists going down there. There were wildlife experts as well, you know, ecologists, people looking at birds, seals, people looking at the kelp forests just under the ice near the edges of Antarctica. So there's a whole range of people. And so one of the sort of inspirations for it, as I said, was Douglas Mawson's expedition 100 years ago, and he'd done a huge amount of science. And there was an incredibly robust data set of climatic data from 100 years ago. So one of the ideas was to try and repeat some of those measurements and to see how this area, this remote area of Antarctica that doesn't get visited that often, how it's changed in the past century. And it's an important century because in those 100 years, we've discovered climate change. We've had huge amounts of industrialization around the world. So this is an important part of the world to understand how it's changed. It's also an important part of the world for global ocean circulation. So many of the global ocean currents that go around the world start off in places like this in Antarctica, Commonwealth Bay, where there's heavy, cold, salty water sinks and then goes along the bottom of the ocean all the way up to the equator. And that's how energy is transferred from the equator all the way down to the poles and, you know, all the way up to the north as well. And so these big ocean currents are responsible for weather, for winds all over the world, incredibly important things. And if those ocean currents start to be affected, you know, the world's climate gets affected. And there's some suggestion that, you know, around other parts of Antarctica, this is being affected. So, you know, there was lots of science going on there to try and measure the salinity of the oceans, the temperature, compare some of that to Mawson's data, and also looking at how all of that is affecting the wildlife, because they're also markers for these things. Ultimately, it's a climate change project. Climate change is behind all of this. And so looking at where the seals are, for example, and what they're eating tells you, you know, what temperatures and what food is available at different parts of the ocean, and how that's changing in the past 100 years tells you, you know, how fishing and all those other things that have happened in the Antarctic, how all those things are changing that part of the world. And it's a very pristine environment, so you have to be very careful and get all the right permits and things to get down there in the first place. So as a natural laboratory, it's sort of unparalleled.
And Lawrence, there's some very intriguing footage that you got of Tracy Rogers darting these huge creatures, these Weddell seals. Just tell me a bit about what it was like to be around that.
That was an extraordinary day. We were at Commonwealth Bay, and Tracy and I and her team, we jumped on these little Argos, which are all-terrain vehicles. They're like little tracked sort of buggies. And we drove into the ice, into a sort of the fast ice for about half an hour over quite kind of bumpy, quite sort of treacherous ice. And we hopped off, and they had spotted on a previous little excursion, they'd spotted an ice hole. And this is where the Weddell seals, they come up and they perch themselves on the ice and to sort of rest, and where they'll look after their young. And she had this... Tracy, what her job involved is taking a pressurized dart rifle, and uses a small biopsy. So what she does is she fires this biopsy that will ping into the fire into the seal and then ping out again, taking with it a tiny bit of blubber, which she can then analyze for the genetics and look at the fur. What the most amazing part about it was that the proximity that you could get to these animals, as a photographer, that being able to be that close to an animal that's completely wild, was an extraordinary privilege.
Tell me a little bit about the early days of realizing you might be able to get into trouble. Lawrence, tell me what that felt like.
There was a moment when I was on the top of the Schakowsky filming a time-lapse sequence as we were moving away from the Hodgman Islands. And there was large icebergs and ice floes, and they were moving around the ship. And I realized that the ship was trying to carve its way through. And watching back the time-lapse footage, I could see sped up motion, the ship pushing through, but then not only getting so far and then having to reverse and then trying another channel and not being able to get through, having to reverse. And it suddenly dawned on me that it looked as though we were having trouble getting out. And I remember running down to Alok, and this was, I think, about the 23rd or of December. And I remember running down to the cabin, finding Alok and sort of saying, I might be going crazy, but I think we're having difficulty getting out. And it just seemed, we were shrugging it off, going, that can't be possible. I'm sure it's fine. But I just remember that vivid moment of it, you really seeing how much ice there was around us and how vulnerable you felt on this ship.
Give me a sense for what the perceived threats were to you then, at the point at which you've decided that you're stuck, but this is more than just getting stuck. There is a risk to the whole expedition.
The captain of the Schakowsky pushed the distress call on Christmas morning, and within an hour, Australian Marine Rescue Coordination Centre had taken control.
And that's a big button to press.
It was a very carefully made decision by the captain alone. It's the captain's decision, and he informed our expedition leaders that this had happened after it happened. So they I think were quite disappointed that we had to go to this position, not because they thought that he'd done the wrong thing or anything like that, but because they thought, oh well, now our expedition has gone from being sort of we are in control and we're a well-found ship being self-sufficient to we need help now. And that's actually, it's not a great position to be in, because suddenly the control of your world is elsewhere. But the Marine Rescue Coordination Centre in Australia, which had jurisdiction of this part of the world, went into action, issued a distress issued an alert to ships in the area. And as it happened, a Chinese icebreaker and a French one were in the area and agreed to come to our position. And we were stuck about 2 miles from the coast of Cape de la Motte in East Antarctica. And we had about 2 miles of ice between us and open water when we got stuck.
Now, look, explain to me what the nature of the threat was, because from the video, from the footage, you see this ship in the middle of a lot of solid-looking ice stuck, but it doesn't seem to be any more risky than that. So just, it was more than that, wasn't it? Explain to me why it was such a risky environment.
Well, ice actually moves a lot more than you would think. You see the pictures and it's quite static, and actually what's happening is that pack ice is forming huge amounts of pressure in different directions. And that pressure is what puts the ship at risk, that it's pushing against it. And the icebergs are of such a, the mass of these icebergs is so huge that they cut through that pack ice almost as if it wasn't there, and they almost operate under their own steam with the wind and currents. And they were moving towards us, or at least in a trajectory that could come quite close to the ship. And so that was the concern, that there's no way that you can control.
I mean, at that point, the term fast ice, I guess, takes on a new significance, doesn't it? I mean, you've got these icebergs moving at what sort of speeds potentially?
Well, icebergs move with the currents and the winds. So if the currents and winds are moving together, and we're talking about winds up to 90 miles an hour, part of the reason we got stuck was there was consistent winds pushing ice towards the continent, and we just happened to get pinned in place. If the winds had shifted, the ice would have dissipated and we could have got out. And that's actually what happened to the Schakowsky eventually. But it was pinning us towards the continent. And so that's how the pack ice moves. The icebergs, obviously, because they're so deep underneath the water. They move with the currents. And so if the two things are moving together, you can have icebergs moving at 2 or 3 or 4 knots, which is, you know, not very fast in the big scheme of things, but it's pretty fast for a massive chunk of ice.
And what would happen? What would have happened if the worst had happened, if one of these things had come through the ice around your ship?
Well, you've seen Titanic, right? So that's essentially what would happen. So
which one of you was going to be Kate Winslet?
Well, I'll sidestep that question neatly to just say, you know, I mean, this is actually quite serious. If an iceberg comes towards the ship, there's no way a ship's going to... I mean, our ship was, you know, strong. It was ice-strengthened. I mean, it was perfectly capable of dealing with these situations down there with the pack ice. But you've got no chance against an iceberg that's heading towards you. It's you're just a fly in Antarctica's grand plan. So, you know, the reason that the rescue coordination centres issued this call to all the other icebreakers in the area and instigated a huge, huge rescue operation, which has had huge impacts on the rest of the Antarctic science program this year. I mean, let's not underestimate that. And the cost of it has been huge. The reason they did that was because they felt that these icebergs could come in our direction, and they didn't want to be making the call in 2 days' time when they were even closer. As it happened, the icebergs moved off in a different direction, so it wasn't a massive problem.
Was there a rehearsed plan, or at least a discussion of what would happen if, before rescue arrived, the ship had to be abandoned? I'm assuming that there was a plan to abandon the ship onto the packed
ice. Well, what you'd have to do is take everyone onto the pack ice, yeah, in tents. That's what would happen. And we're talking about 0 degrees most of the time. I mean, sometimes when it was sunny, it was felt a bit warmer, but the air temperature was still 0 degrees. And when the winds came, I mean, we're talking minus 20, minus 30 wind chill. So that's what we'd have to people would be sitting in.
So you realise you're not getting out of there by sea, either by your own power or that of another ship. And you realise that the option is helicopters. How did you feel about that?
Initially, we thought that it was going to be quite a straightforward operation, that the Chinese could essentially collect us from a suitable ice floe near the ship and then just take us directly to the Aurora Australis, the Australian icebreaker. But then it became clear through communications of the captains that the helicopter couldn't land on the Australian ship because the helideck just couldn't support the weight of the helicopter. So that added this layer of complication that the Australian captain had to find a position in the ice that was next to a suitable ice floe that was strong enough to support the weight of the Chinese helicopter. So that added this sort of, they had to maneuver and find this, and that added extra time and a sort of unknown quality because we still didn't know whether that was going to happen. There was a contingency plan that we were going to move on to the Xulong, the Chinese icebreaker. Then it transpired that they didn't have enough berths for 50 passengers. They only had 19. And so we were thinking, well, will 20 of us sleep on the floor? The Chinese very kindly offered that and said, look, we can feed you. That's not a problem. We can do that. So there are all these different sort of variations of the plan that were constantly evolving. And I think when the day actually arrived, the morning that we woke up, it wasn't on. The passengers had actually arranged a little writers' festival to keep people occupied and to keep morale up. They organised a little get-together down on the ice because we were actually allowed to walk around the ship pretty much. The ice was strong enough to take, you know, and they did a careful recce and they marked out safe areas. So everyone was sort of enjoying this nice sunny day on the ice, and around lunchtime suddenly we got the call. And we've been prepared. They told us to make sure that we had a go bag ready, so that in an emergency you drop everything else and you just take a little backpack that has only your essentials in. So they sort of carefully prepped us for this moment. But my memory is that it happened very quickly and that we thought it wasn't going to happen that day. And then suddenly the whole thing changed and we had an hour to get ready and the helicopter was arriving.
In telling this story, you're safe and you're well and everything worked out absolutely like clockwork and perfectly. And there's a huge amount of planning involved. And what you miss is the amount of stress and problems that the captains and the organisers of the expedition and the organisers of the rescue, wherever they were in the world, how much stress they had, because there were so many ducks that had to line up in a row for helicopters to land next to our ship and then fly all the way across 20 miles of sea ice to the Aurora Australis, land there with a bunch of people who are not Antarctic veterans, you know, many of whom have never been there before, walking across sea ice that was covered in snow, where you could easily fall up to your waist in that stuff, with the massive, huge helicopters downdraft. This is not standard stuff. And the fact that it worked without anyone even getting a scratch is a testament to how well organized it was. Having said that, they did prepare us for days and days and days. Greg would constantly have these briefings where he'd say, yeah, get this go bag ready. Because if things go wrong within an hour of the operation starting, you're not going to get any of the rest of your stuff. Your stuff's going to stay in on the Schakalsky, or it'll be ditched in the ocean or something. And we had to go through a moment where Lawrence and I and everyone, we thought, we're going to lose all our stuff apart from our toothbrush, maybe a camera and some underwear. Those decisions were what made it real to think this is actually more serious than you think. You know, it's not like losing your bags in an airline or something and you get insurance and everything's easy, you go home. No, it's like, you lose everything and you have to spend 3 weeks on a ship with just what you're wearing. So that's when it made you realize just how serious it was. And when you go through all the elements, if you do a sort of a finite element analysis of this operation, amazing how complicated it was.
Did you end up taking everything with you?
If you looked at Alok and I as we left, I mean, we looked ridiculous. We had so many bags.
We always look ridiculous. Let's be honest.
But we had with the video aspect of our coverage meant that I just had to take so much different amounts of gear, from satellite units to tripods to loads of different accessories, and so we were not light footed in, and so there was a real I was gearing up to have to write to my boss to say, look, I've had to leave £10,000 worth of equipment behind, sorry. We somehow managed to when I actually went onto the helicopter, I mean, I looked a bit ridiculous, but I had about three or four cameras strapped to me. I had a GoPro on my head, I had a video camera around my shoulder, and a stills camera.
And we were wearing as many of our clothes as we could. I mean, partly for good reasons, because we were outside and it was full polar gear. Again, it was like one of those hints of danger at the edges of what was happening. It was a very sunny day. Actually, as I said, it worked out fine, but Greg had said to us, you have to wear full polar gear, i.e. many, many layers on your legs, arms, on your head, because if the helicopter has to ditch or it doesn't go anywhere, you have to spend a night on the ice, you have to be ready. And we didn't have to do those things in the end, but there was that element of sort of danger at the edge of this. This is not a normal environment.
So you're back here now, safe and well. From the Aurora Australis, you went to Hobart, didn't you? And was that really where, I guess, the excitement ended in terms of your rescue?
Well, we arrived on the Aurora Australis 20 minutes after leaving the Schakalsky, after seeing this enormous expanse of sea ice underneath it. So it was quite epic, actually. And the first thing I remember noticing was, what's weird about, I mean, this is maybe just my mind working in this particular way, but everything about it was exciting. And so you sort of collect all these details, because I had to write something straight afterwards about the whole thing and file it back, was that we went backwards in time by 5 hours as soon as we arrived at the Aurora Australis. I mean, this is something that I didn't appreciate until I got to the Antarctic, which is that you can choose whatever time zone you like when you're in the Antarctic. And generally speaking, ships choose the time zone of the port they leave from. So the Schakalsky was on New Zealand time, and the Aurora Australis was on Western Australia time, which meant that it was 5 hours behind. So we left the Schakalsky at 7 p.m. and arrived at the Aurora Australis at 2 p.m. the same day. And so it was time for dinner by the time we got there, and we had a second dinner. Anyway, that's by itself. So when you say anticlimactic, the first couple of days were just decompression, because it had been such an intense while, which I don't think anyone had consciously thought, but it had been, I think, especially for the ship expedition leaders. We didn't see them for a couple of days. They were just holed up in their cabins, I think just not having to make decisions and being quite pleased about it. But then Lawrence and I were quite busy, actually, in that time, because we did a lot of interviews with people which form the spine of the film that is coming out later this week, and some of the articles that I've written, which is all about reflection. And in a way, that's what you want. You want the reflections of these people from the inside. There have been lots of stories told about this expedition from the outside, and there's a huge amount of media interest over Christmas and New Year. There have been articles about what might have gone wrong, etc., etc. None of which are, I think, getting close to what was actually going on inside. And
Simon, I want to come to that a little bit, because some of the reflection from outside has been somewhat recriminatory. I mean, do you feel in any way that that was, the criticisms were justified?
Well, when so there's a range of criticism about the expedition and then the rescue efforts and so on. Some of which is very quickly and easily to dismiss. There were climate skeptics, for example, who were sort of amused by the fact that a group of climate scientists seemed to be stuck in ice. Obviously, the scientists involved, when they were asked these questions during interviews over Christmas, they had to be sort of balanced and calm about the whole thing. And I've got no such boundaries. And I'm just saying that there's no point listening to lunatics who don't understand science and who don't really read the information, to be honest. The people who think that this sea ice just happened because it's actually getting colder down there, they're insane. And it's not that. What happened was that this sea ice is very, very old. It was very, very thick. And it turned up from one part of Antarctica because of weather systems, and moved from one part of the Antarctic to the other. If this was fresh sea ice, i.e. if the sea around us had just frozen, the Schakalsky would have just moved through it with no problem, because it would have been less than half a meter thick. And the Schakalsky was just plowing through that stuff on the way into the Antarctic. So that's all I have to say about that. The more serious criticism was from other scientists, who said that perhaps the scientific merit of this expedition wasn't great enough for then the subsequent impact it's had on the scientific programs of national institutions. So,
which have been substantial.
Yeah, they have. And so, the just to sort of outline what that means, the Zhu Long is a national, as Chinese national programs icebreaker. The Astrolab, which is the French icebreaker, is also a national program icebreaker. And so is the Aurora Australis. It's the Australian Antarctic Division. So we're talking three national Antarctic programs. And the summer Antarctic season, when all the research resupply to these bases happens, is very short. It's November to February-ish. And you have to resupply, get all the scientists in there, and then out again very quickly. So essentially a 2 or 3 week delay, which is potentially what the Schakalsky's caused, is significant. There's no, I mean, we're not. I don't think anyone's suggesting that didn't happen. There were lots of questions raised in various places about whether the expedition should have gone on and whether it should have been there and stuff. The impacts of the program are hard to determine right now. We spoke to the head of the Antarctic Division, the Australian Antarctic Division, who said that there have been significant impacts, but it's hard to quantify those until for a few more weeks, because you don't know what has or hasn't been done. When we got onto the Aurora, the captain told us that the expedition would be late, and in the end it was, you know, a week late back into Hobart, but that a lot of the research that they needed to do had finished anyway. They'd compromised on some of it, but the research had happened. And the chief scientist of the AAD also said, and a lot of scientists said this, which is that no Antarctic summer goes to plan anyway. I mean, our expedition itself didn't go to plan.
And all those things are understood, but I guess, you know, the rescue was required. The delays are a necessary result of that. I guess there's the final question, which is, was the expedition of which you were a part sufficiently prepared for the waters and the ice into which it sailed?
This is good. A good question, because I think you look at it in two ways. In one sense, you can think the ship got out eventually when the winds changed on January the 7th, and it got back to Bluff in New Zealand, actually a week before we got back to Hobart. So the ship survived, it's safe, it's undamaged. And so, yes, it was prepared for those situations, and your answer is there. But I suppose the bigger question is, should it have ever been in that situation in the first place? Should it have got stuck? And all the Antarctic researchers we've spoken to have said that ships get stuck routinely. They just have to wait. The question is, should the question, I suppose, is should the emergency distress beacons have been placed? And that was not a decision for the expedition to make. It was the Australian Marine Rescue Coordination Centre. It was the captains of the ships. There have been huge impacts of all of that. But that's just what happens down there. It's not that the expedition members were crying out and saying, right, get us three icebreakers immediately. In a way, the complaints by scientists who have seen impacts on their programs, they're justified. If you prepared for years for a project and in one summer it's something like this happens and you get 1 week instead of six weeks to do your work, I mean, you're going to be annoyed. But for me personally, I think to myself, well, the system is set up that if ships get into trouble, other ships go and help them. And that is just, there are consequences to that. And many of the scientists that were on the Schakalsky actually have had their own work really severely affected in the past by this sort of thing. And it's easy for them to say, oh, well, we didn't mind. But genuinely, they would say, well, this is what happens. And entire programs have been wiped out like that. Could systems be better? Well, that's what's going to happen next, is I think a lot of people are going to do inquiries and look at whether things could be more efficient. They're going to look at perhaps why we specifically got stuck. Were there reasons why we might have got out before the winds turned up and stuff? And I think that a lot of that is difficult to speculate about, because certainly we, and certainly no one in the media who is speculating about this, has the information, because they weren't there. And I mean, we were there, but even we don't have that information. It's very difficult. The ice maps before we went into this particular place where we got stuck did not show that this ice was going to turn up. And even the day we got stuck, the ice map showed that there was ways out. So it goes to show, satellites, all sorts of other things can show you all sorts of things. But if you're not there, then you don't know what's happening.
Guys, just to finish up, really, back home now, enjoying your skinny latte in central London. Do you miss it? And what have you taken away from that experience?
I do miss it. It was a very magical and beautiful place, and in one day you would go from seeing minke whales to Weddell seals to Adelie penguins. And for me, I think the being immersed in that environment where wildlife is in such abundance around you, for me, that's what I'll always take away as being the really kind of more special moments of the trip.
I mean, I thought to myself as soon as we left, I need to work out how to come back here. And it sounds crazy that you spend 2 months somewhere and you think, I've barely scratched the surface. I mean, it's a huge place, Antarctica. We saw one element of one bit of coastline. I mean, I had the privilege of going to Mawson's huts, which were on the continent itself. But even then I felt like, well, I'm as far away from home as I've ever been in my life. But I still think, well, there's still another 1,000 miles to go to the actual bottom of the world, or top of the world, depending on which way up you want to be. So why wouldn't I try and get back and do some of these things? And I want to try and work my way back there somehow.
You can watch Lawrence's film of their Antarctic adventure exclusively on theguardian.com from this coming Saturday, the 1st of March, and read Alok's account in The Guardian in paper and digital form from the same day on. And that's all we have for you on this week's edition of Science Weekly. But from me, Kevin Fong, and producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.